Blog Talk Radio.
January 18th, 2012, and this is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Pope Runyon, and tonight we present an in-depth interview with the distinguished author and researcher, Dr. Joseph P. Farrell. And we'll focus on his 2007 book, The Philosopher's Stone. That's from Farrell House. And that's Alchemy and the Secret Research for Exotic Matter. Now, in this work, Dr. Farrell traces the course of alchemy from possible antediluvian secret science through classical Neoplatonist Hermetic concepts, exotic medieval formulas to modern quantum mechanics functioning on a different model than the Einstein's relativity. We'll discuss the American alchemical gold and the mysterious Russian red mercury, the Nazi atomic bomb, which they may very well have had before we did, and the torsion theory of quantum physics behind the awesome Nazi Bell Project. As I said, this is a show that will bend your mind and set you to wondering about the real history of history. And we have Dr. Farrell already on the line, so let me just say this before we start off with our first question here. That Dr. Farrell has a very distinguished background. He has a doctorate in patristics. Now, in case you don't know what patristics is, that's the study of the writings of the original church fathers, and that led him into the study of alchemy in that direction. And he also has a background in mathematics, and he is a very, very astute researcher into these particular subjects. Now, he's the author of a series of books, starting with the Giza Death Star, and it's a series of three books regarding the antediluvian uses of the Great Pyramid by pre-Egyptian sources. And this is very, very well presented and researched. And then he's also the author of a book which relates to what we're talking to about tonight, and that is The Reich of the Black Sun. And The Reich of the Black Sun, and it also has a video presentation on that one. The Reich of the Black Sun involves some of these Nazi experiments that went on during World War II that we're just beginning to find out about today. And so, Dr. Farrell's on the line, and I'm gonna. Ask the first question here and let him tell us about the connection between classical alchemy back in the days of Alexandria and earlier, and the classical alchemy, what was behind it, what he found out about in researching the Church Fathers' writings, and in the Vatican, and what he found out about this and how it relates to how this ancient alchemy, Hermetic alchemy, relates to the to the quantum physics, quantum mechanics, and quantum physics of the 20th century. Dr. Farrell,
yes.
Can you enlighten us on that?
Well, thanks for having me on, Polk. I really appreciate it. It's an interesting question. I do have to clarify, I never did any research at the Vatican. Most of my research was done at the University of Oxford at the Bodleian Library there. But it's a very interesting question that you pose. And in The Philosopher's Stone, as a matter of fact, in many of my books, I talk about what I call the ancient topological metaphor of the physical medium. And essentially what the ancients believed was that the physical medium or ether or zero-point energy, whatever you want to call it, was an information-creating medium. In other words, right there what they've said is that the stuff underlying the material world that we see is already a kind of philosopher's stone because it transmutes itself into a variety of manifestations in our physical world. And the connection there with quantum mechanics is very, very interesting because there is a version of the standard model of quantum mechanics that was first sort of propounded by the physicist Paul Dirac back in the 1930s that said that the zero-point energy was in fact an energy that existed in the vacuum flux of space-time itself and that particles arose and annihilated in from this virtual sea of energy that surrounds us, and it's very much a part of quantum mechanical thinking. So you have a very peculiar connection right there between some of the theories of some of the quantum physicists and this idea of the ancients that the physical medium was transmutative. And once you've said that, you're really raising the prospect that the whole alchemical tradition may in fact be based upon some sort of declined scientific legacy from a very high civilization that pre-existed the known civilizations that you and I know about, Egypt and Sumer and the Indus Valley and so on. And that's basically the approach that I've taken in all of those books that deal with ancient history, ancient technology, you know, the Giza Death Star books, the Cosmic War book, the Philosopher's Stone, certainly. And it's also very much a major part of a book that just came out last year toward the middle of the year called Grid of the Gods that I co-authored with a friend of mine by the name of Dr. Scott DeHart, who's also another Oxford graduate. So it's a very fascinating field, and it goes just about everywhere, as you
yeah.
indicated with your question.
Well, the aspect of alchemy that, of course, fascinates us here is the creation of this this philosopher's stone, which affects projection and the final process in alchemy, and this substance which will somehow or other transform lead into gold and produce the elixir of life and will do just about anything that you want to heals and it heals people of just about any disease imaginable, and it's a wonderful substance. The approach to it seems to have been, as far as you know, we can gather, looking at alchemy from our perspective, that they were taking an Aristotelian, of course, you know, they're Aristotle's version of physics, and that they were trying to alter molecular structure. You know, they call it that. But they're trying to by a slow heating process and almost like a gourmet cooking process, as opposed to as opposed to the you know the chemical process of today. And but what fascinates me is how you know, one of the things that's really, really good about your Philosopher's Stone book is that you don't just lay all this on everybody before they're ready for it. You build them up. One of the things I really enjoyed about this book was you carefully lead the reader on through and explain everything as you go along, and then start laying one thing on top of another on top of another until finally you realize that this is what it is you're getting at. And so here you set forth using our old friend Homo Yard. Is that book on alchemy, Homo Yard's book, it's the best popular book on alchemy that, you know, I guess that anybody's ever done. And you use Homo Yard kind of as your guide on that. And right. You got us all through and got us all worked, you know, where we understood as much as anybody could understand what the classical alchemists are trying to do. And then we move on to what this fellow Hudson out in Arizona did just a few years ago.
Yeah.
Now, can you tell us about that?
Well, David Hudson, as I'm sure your readers are probably familiar with, made a rather interesting discovery in the soil of his farm in Arizona. He discovered that he had soil that was very, very rich in metals in the platinum group, osmium, iridium, and platinum, and so on. And he took specimens of this stuff and noticed that if he left it out into the sun to dry, that it would suddenly explode with a blinding flash of light, but yet there would be no ordinary shockwave that you would associate with a customary explosion. And through careful research, he discovered that there were certain corporations that had noticed the same thing and recorded the same thing in their laboratory experiments about these platinum metal groups. And lo and behold, he decided to start investigating this stuff chemically. And the first thing he noticed is that this stuff would reduce itself to a fine white powder, which should set off alarm bells already for anybody familiar with alchemical literature, because this is one of the forms that the medieval and ancient alchemists say that the Philosopher's Stone exists in. And they also say something else very significant. They say that this white powder, this gold of the Philosopher's Stone, is very, very lightweight. Well, Hudson had noticed the same thing. He had found this white powder residue, and when he went to weigh it, he discovered that even though the metals that he was weighing were chemically testing in the platinum group metals, in other words, they were responding chemically as platinum group metals would do, they nevertheless had lost a certain percentage of their weight, a very significant percentage of their weight, something like 44%. Well, he went further and investigated a paper of the American theoretical physicist Hal Puthoff, who had predicted that two-dimensional semiconductors would lose approximately 44% of their weight. Well, further testing led him to the conclusion that what he had done with all of his chemical testing and so on and so forth was that somehow he had created what he called orbitally rearranged monatomic elements, or ORMEs as they're abbreviated for short. And basically what that abbreviation means is that the bonding properties between the atoms in this metal were no longer molecular in nature. In other words, he was dealing with individual atoms in this white powder that weren't bonding to each other and that for whatever reason had lost a certain amount of their mass. So the point here is that Hudson really stumbled across a modern manifestation of exactly what the alchemists were saying in alchemical literature, that the Philosopher's Stone was a fine white powder, that it weighed a very, very fine portion of its original weight, and moreover, he discovered that this would only work in the light of the sun. And you find very interesting references, as I point out in the Philosopher's Stone, you find these very interesting references in alchemical literature to the fact that these experiments can only be performed at certain proper times, certain phases of the moon, certain positions of the sun and planets, and so on and so forth. So again, it would look or appear, at least at first glance, that we're looking at sort of a modern confirmation of some of the things that the alchemists were writing about.
Yeah, well, this was absolutely fascinating, and as you mentioned, the astrological connection here, as we theorize, the zodiac, and I'm falling back on DeSanta and Van Decken now, you know, that is really a great deal older. The astrological
yes.
calculations are a great deal older than just 4,000 years ago.
Well, this is in fact what the Babylonian texts themselves will say, that these astrological tables and so on that you find in cuneiform tablets are based on observations that span tens of thousands of years. And in fact, the Egyptians will tell you the very same thing. So, you know, from my standpoint, again, using the model that we're dealing very possibly with a legacy of a very high science from a very high civilization that, for whatever reason, is no longer there, that it stands to reason then that alchemy preserves some of that high science, namely this idea that the physical medium is a transmutative information creating medium. And that's really the key link between the ancient alchemy and the modern science.
And that leads me to the question that I was discussing before we went on the air. How much do you think now, how much of what we have, in surviving Hermetic philosophy and science, and Hermetic science, alchemy and astrology related, how much of this is cargo cultism, and how much is, and I don't want to answer my own question here, but how much of this thing is cargo cultism, and how much of it is really people who have, ever since the beginning, have really known kind of what was really going on?
Oh boy, that's a great question. It's really very, very difficult to pin down. My own personal belief, and I've written a number of books in this kind of ancient technology, philosophy, physics series. And based upon that, Polk, what I would say is right now that we're dealing with a very high civilization that, in my opinion, blew itself apart in a war. And because of this, as they realized that their infrastructure was crumbling and that they were not going to be able to preserve the technologies and so on that sustained that civilization, that what they did was they immediately began to encode this science in such a way within mythologies and so on that could be handed down through time, easily memorized, transmitted, and so on and so forth. And eventually, that science would become apparent again when humanity had reached a similar pitch of scientific development and was able to look back at some of these myths and decode them. That's quite literally what I believe happened. So I think most of it is that you're dealing with things like alchemy, with astrology, with these traditions within esotericism. I think what you're looking at is a declined scientific legacy rather than cargo cultism per se. There's certainly bound to be an element of mimicry and copying and so on and so forth. That's undeniable. But even then, I think that they were so successful in their ability to encode certain things and certain physical phenomena within these myths that even in its copied form, they managed to preserve the central core of the truth that they were trying to communicate from ancient times. That's a really, really good question, and you know we could probably talk about all night.
Yeah, you know, we could have a symposium on that. I mean, on that question. I'll just say this: I thoroughly agree with your answer. I think, well, Jacques Vallée, you know, has oftentimes in his work he's hinted at the hidden college.
Yes.
And he's hinted at the hidden college, and I think So I think the hidden college does exist,
Well,
and
tend
that
to
was.
think so. I tend to think so too. I think you're dealing with groups like the Pythagoreans, the various mystery schools in ancient times, with alchemy. Certainly, you're dealing with alchemy, with a very definite underground sort of hermetic tradition, particularly in the West, that preserved all of this very intentionally. And as I point out in the Philosopher's Stone, even did so under the very thin veneer guise of the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, because really what you're dealing with there is you're dealing with a mathematical and topological metaphor rather than a theological doctrine per se. And this I think, is one reason it was so successful in being able both to hide itself within the West and to sustain itself until it was able to break free of the Christian constraints during the Renaissance and reemerge more or less back into the open. But I agree with you. I think a lot of this is a hidden college at work.
Well, you know, I want to point out that you mentioned in dealing with classical and medieval alchemy that you brought it to our attention that St. Augustine was a Neoplatonist, and of course,
yes.
As we know, Hermetic philosophy is an amalgam of Neoplatonic philosophy and Gnostic theology, if you want to put it that
way. To a certain extent, I would caution against identifying it too closely with Gnosticism, because in Hermeticism you don't have quite as strong of a dualism between the
so-called
spirit world.
That's right. That's what
it
says, an amalgam.
Matter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it is an amalgam.
And this enabled the church fathers because of this Neoplatonic sort of core philosophy that this enabled them to. Alchemy had a comfortable survival spot.
It did primarily in the Christian West. It's a bit of a different case in the Christian East, because the attitude of the Greek fathers was very different toward philosophy than of the Western fathers. But in the main, I think, you're right, that this is something that in one form or another, in both East and West, it went underground. It survived in Christian veneer. In fact, I have a friend that's writing a book right now that's going to be very, very explosive to the thesis of just exactly what is happening historically within the context of the Eastern Church on that score. But
that'll be interesting to.
No, I can't do that. I don't want to steal his thunder, because I don't want to spoil it, because you know he's come up with it's major mega tonnage. Let's put it that way, and I don't want to steal his thunder, but. It's quite a breathtaking.
At least you can tell us who he is, maybe, and so we can wait for it with bated breath.
I don't even want to do that because I sound probably terribly like I'm waffling, and I'm really not trying to sound that way. But he's fairly well known in theological circles, and I simply don't want to. I don't want to tip any hat too early before he's prepared to speak and talk and write publicly about what he's up to. But it's a major explosive airburst. Let's put it that way.
Well, we'll wait for it. And hopefully it'll get out before December 21st. And after that, maybe we'll have to circulate it in copied manuscript if that happens. Yeah. Now you know, get back along to our line here on Philosopher's Stone. Okay, we discussed Hudson's American alchemical gold, that white powder,
right?
And now. We're going to move according to my outline here. We're going to move over and talk about Russian red mercury. But in a way, though, Russian red mercury, in the sequence here, Russian red mercury, as we, I think we realize that it may have had an origin in Nazi Germany.
Yes, that's my opinion.
That's your opinion, and very, very, you know, you get a good case for that. But I think maybe on the red mercury attack, maybe we ought to talk about the Russian, that mystical Russian physicist,
Nikolai Kozarev?
Kozarev, that's right. Dr. Kozarev,
well,
his theories.
Yeah, Kozarev is a very, very interesting man. In fact, I speak about him not only in The Philosopher's Stone, but again at the very beginning of The Grid of the Gods, which just came out last year. Kozarev, for those who don't know him, he was a Russian astrophysicist. He was quite famous in his day. He was internationally known for his work on stars and cataloging stars. And in the process of doing his work, he noticed that according to the standard theory of stars as being kind of chained up hydrogen bombs, if you will, or, you know, thermonuclear fusion reactions that are not able to completely explode because they're under such immense gravitational pressure. That's basically the model that falls out of some aspects of Einstein's general relativity. But he noticed that stars were putting out not enough neutrino energy for that model to be true. And therefore, he came to the conclusion that set him off on a path of research that to this day is rather astonishing, that stars had to be transducing energy from some other source. Now, this again is very interesting, Polk, because if you go back to the ancient Egyptians, they viewed stars, of course, as kind of gateways. And when Kozarev said this, what he was really getting at was that stars were transducing energy from the fabric of space-time itself. And this began a whole series of theoretical papers that he published. They weren't circulated or widely known outside of the Soviet Union. But in the course of these papers, he came to the conclusion that time itself was a kind of energy. So he began a series of experiments inside the Soviet Union that went deeply, deeply black. They were very deeply classified, and I'll get to the reasons why in a minute. But during these experiments, he would do things like measure gyroscopes. He would take very, very finely balanced scales and measure things. And he began to notice that his measurements varied according to the position of the planets, according to when he performed them. In other words, if he performed them during the summer or during the winter, where he performed them, and so on and so forth. Now, the reason that all of this is significant is, let's go back to my remark about chained-up hydrogen bombs and that model of stars. Because, of course, you remember that in the 1950s, when Kozarev first started thinking about these things, both the United States and the Soviet Union were testing hydrogen bombs, all right? And in fact, I devote a whole chapter in Grid of the Gods on hydrogen bombs themselves and the fact that when they were first being tested, they far exceeded the predicted yields, all right? And there are a bunch of excuses, in my opinion, that the military gave for their unusually high yields for these devices. But the bottom line is that I think that both the United States and the Soviet Union discovered that the yield of these devices would vary depending upon when they set them off and where. In other words, depending upon the geometry of local space-time. And that these bombs, just like stars, acted as transducers of that energy of space-time, just as Kozarev
hypothesized. They were pulling energy from another dimension, right?
Yes, they were pulling energy from another dimension. Yeah. Exactly so. And, you know, I think this is probably, you know, this is pure speculation, but it's argued in reason speculation in my books that this is probably the big secret of the nuclear powers and probably the big reason why the recent additions to the nuclear club keep testing these devices, because they've made the discovery that when they set these things off, they're getting yields that fall outside the predicted mathematical predictions of what the yields would be. And this has been true in most every case that they've tested these devices. So, yeah, Kozarev laid quite a theoretical foundation for all of this. Now, Russian Red Mercury comes into this picture because, of course, during the 1990s, Red Mercury was the big nuclear scare. It was supposed to be a substance that was a very heavy density. In other words, it weighed a great deal. And it was also kind of a liquid goo that was cherry red in its composition. And again, I thought that was very, very peculiar because, again, you have descriptions in alchemical literature of the Philosopher's Stone in some of its manifestations being a liquid and being red or maroon colored in nature and very heavy. So yet again, we have another fascinating and, in my opinion, not very coincidental tie between alchemy and what's going on in science.
Yeah, that's right. Now, along with that, immediately what comes to mind is does this presage modern M theory and the
modern what theory?
M theory, you know, the
membrane theory,
string theory,
the ultimate, the final. Well, I don't know if there's any final string theory, but what we refer to as M theory, you know, the string theory that has, oh gosh, about 11 dimensions to it.
Well, it depends on the dimensional rotation of the theory. In some versions of string theory, in some rotations, it has 10 dimensions. In other rotations of the theory, it has 26. I'm going to have to kind of waffle on that answer because it's both a yes and a no. The yes part of it is that string theory, if you read the textbook on graduate level textbook on string theory written by Dr. Kaku, it's a 560 some page monster tome, and it's full of so much bizarre and very arcane mathematics. It's quite a thing to struggle through, let me tell you. But in the sense
I'm just
that you're
the word for it. I'm gonna wade through it. Go ahead.
Yeah, don't wade through it. that would be my advice. Stick to his popular works, but. The bottom line on the yes part of the answer is that string theory, in the sense that it's dealing with mere rotations and vibrations within very, very minute fibers or threads, as it were, strings as they call them, that can transform themselves into the various manifestations of matter. In that sense, yes, it's a very, very alchemical theory, and it's also alchemical in the sense that you're dealing almost exclusively with a mathematical formalism. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I think you're dealing with in ancient texts, as I lay out in the Philosopher's Stone. There's a bit of mathematics in it. But my no part of the answer goes to the difficulty of string theory, and that is that string theory is an untestable theory. It is such a mathematical formalism that it is beyond testability in terms of modern physical ability. You can test certain aspects of the standard model of quantum mechanics, but string theory itself, as other physicists have pointed out, suffers from that one problem. So my own druthers, my own intuition on string theory is that you're dealing with a situation within the elaboration of modern science rather similar to the nominalist-realist debate during the Middle Ages. You're dealing with a theory that has become so complex and so patched up that what's really needed is a paradigm change, and that's why I approach all of this stuff from the standpoint of torsion rather than from the standpoint of string theory.
Yeah. And that brings us to torsion.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bring it, that brings it, boy, you're right on cue. That brings us right to torsion. Now, torsion, for a while, you know, you're reading the book, you teased us along with torsion, and then finally, you reveal it. It's just the right point in the book, and you start talking about what it really is. So at this point, tell us about torsion.
Well, torsion has two different mathematical expressions, and then I'll talk about the concept. The first mathematical expression is called the Einstein-Cartan torsion tensor, and that, in most versions of physics that you read, is so minute in its effects that most physicists disregard it, all right? There is another mathematical version of the torsion tensor called the Ricci tensor, which returns much larger results. And the reason why is that in the Ricci tensor, you're dealing with what's called dynamic torsion. Now, that brings us to the concept. Torsion is basically the spiraling and folding and pleating of local space-time. And the illustration I like to give people to picture it in their minds is if they can imagine taking an empty soda can and then wringing it like a dish rag in their hands, in that counter-rotation that you're dealing with when you're wringing the soda can will spiral the can, will fold it, will pleat it, and the ends of the can draw closer together, all right? That's what torsion does to the fabric of space-time. Now, in the Ricci tensor version of it, what you're dealing with are several rotating systems within several other rotating systems. In other words, you're dealing with basically the real world, because the real world, as we all know, has rotating systems within rotating systems within rotating systems. Just think of the planet Earth rotating on its axis and then revolving around the sun, and the sun in turn is rotating on its axis, and it's revolving around the center of the Milky Way galaxy, and so on and so forth. So you're dealing with dynamic torsion. And in that model, what you're dealing with then are overlapping spiraling and foldings and pleatings. So this is, I think, this is the kind of vortex mechanics I think that physics really needs to be looking at and dealing a great deal more with. And in fact, quantum mechanics does look at rotation very, very closely and uses models of rotation in its descriptions of various particles and quarks and so on and so forth. So in that respect, quantum mechanics, I think, is a much truer model of physical reality than Einstein's general relativity, because in general relativity, of course, you're not dealing with rotating masses. They're just sort of there and warping space-time. But the interesting thing...
To my hermetic perspective, this feels right. It feels much... It really does. In fact, I think about William Butler Yeats's gyres, he's from a mystical, poetic point of view, he's visualizing this.
Uh-huh.
So it feels right. Now, a couple of questions on this, though. We know that in enriching uranium, which we're going to get into in a minute, we know that cyclotrons and centrifuges are very important in intensifying the radioactivity of whatever. Well, they didn't have to. And I guess the cyclotron and the centrifuges were probably didn't have to. Have quantum mechanics to develop those, or maybe they did. I don't know, but what I'm wondering is the ancient alchemists, could they possibly have put a spin on anything? Would they have had any kind of technology that they could have done this with, besides whirling it around their head with a, like a bull roarer?
Well, that's another good question. It really goes to the question of what sort of technology was really around in ancient times, and we discussed that before the show. And I suppose this is as good of a place to address it as any.
What comes to mind, though, is Hero's steam engine.
Yeah.
Remember that ball with the two spouts on it?
Sure, yeah.
In high school physics, they told us that, they had this steam engine, but they didn't know what to do with it.
You could conceive that the ancients had some sort of technology. I mean, my word. The first real example of a steam engine goes back to the 13th century in the Byzantine Empire, believe it or not. So, you know, we in the West tend to have a rather narrow view of technological development because many of these things were there in some precursor form.
Oh, that Antrika computer, that Antrika bronze computer is absolutely awesome.
Go ahead.
On torsion theory, this moves us, or should move us, time-wise here, so we can cover enough of this. This should move us into the Nazi Bell project, which of course is super torsion. And the serum, which also relates to possibly the original origin of red mercury. So you want to discuss this with us?
Sure. The Nazi Bell project, for those who don't know the story, and I've written many, many books about this project. It really is probably the core secret weapons project of Nazi Germany. And the reason I say that is that within the documents within Nazi Germany that refer to this project, it is the only project of their secret weapons project that was given a classification or described as Kriegsentscheidend, which in German means war decisive, all right? Not even that their atom bomb project was ever described with that word. So this is something way, way beyond the atom bomb. Now, just to give your listeners a quick rundown of what the Bell is. The Bell was obviously bell-shaped. It was about 12 to 15 feet wide, about 15 to 18 feet tall. It was cased in a kind of a ceramic metal. On the inside of this thing, there were two hollow counter-rotating drums, all right? And I believe, for reasons that I outline in my book, Secrets of the Unified Field, that these drums were stacked one on top of the other. Now, into these drums, they put a serum, which was codenamed Serum 525, all right? Now, in my research, I've basically narrowed the ingredients of this serum down. I talk about this in the Philosopher's Stone, as a matter of fact, down to some compound of mercury and thorium-229 isomer, all right? Now, why thorium-229? Why an isomer? Well, an isomer, in case people don't know what that is, an isomer is a special kind of radioactive isotope whose nucleus is in a very, very high state of spin. And when that spin is decelerated, it releases gobs and gobs of gamma ray radiation, all right? Thorium-229 isomer just happens to have a very low threshold of stability. In other words, it does not take much energy to get it to stop spinning and spit out all those gamma rays. Now, one of the peculiarities of the German atomic bomb project that the Allies discovered as they went into Germany was precisely that the Nazis had been stockpiling massive amounts of thorium for some reason, and nobody to this day in the Allied scientific community can really explain what they were doing with all this thorium. Well, in my opinion, what they were doing was they were separating thorium-229 isomer out of all of their thorium stockpiles to put into this serum-525. Now, this serum, in turn, they would put inside those counter-rotating drums in the Bell. They would spin these drums up to tremendously high rates of revolution in those mechanical drums, and then they would electrically polarize the drums with the central axis of the bell device itself and pulse this serum with extremely high voltage direct current electricity. What that would do in turn would be to create a plasma in the mercury thorium compound. And again, when we say plasma, guess what we're back to? We're back to the sun. We're back to hydrogen bonds.
Mm-hmm.
Only this plasma, just like the sun, is in a state of rotation. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I believe what this does is it transduces energy, just like we've said before. And what the Nazis were after in this device then, in my opinion, was they were using it as a gateway technology to lead them to three things. The first thing was as a supply of limitless energy, all right? The second thing was as a practical field propulsion device, because, in other words, this high-spinning plasma is going to have a tremendous electrogravitational effect. And in fact, when you study the Bell Project, you discover that the concentration camp inmates that survived the war and that worked on the project described it at night as actually levitating above the tree line close to their camp. So they were after, in other words, they were after the secret of anti-gravity with this device. But the third thing, and this is quite the crucial point, the third thing that they were after was a doomsday weapon, because what they're really doing is they are attempting to engineer a technology which will allow them to engineer the fabric of space-time, as it were, locally on the laboratory bench. When you've said that, what you've really said is that if you were to weaponize that idea, turn it into a weapon, then you potentially would have a weapon that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. And that's the reason that they classified it so extremely high. And in my opinion, Polk, the other part of the story, the bad news, is that this is one of those projects that, in my opinion, that my research has led me to conclude that the Nazis kept their hands on this project after the war. They did not allow it to fall into the hands of the Soviets or the Allies. And they continued to research aspects of this project down in Argentina after the war under the aegis of Juan Perón's government. And that part of the story I talk about in a book called The Nazi International.
Yeah. Well, that's a kind of a scary thing to think about.
Yeah, I
was also wondering, though, just something else about the Bell that I wanted to ask you. The Bell, in a way, is like the Philosopher's Stone. We wonder how many different things can it do. And I thought maybe, as I was going through the whole process, reading your book, and you know, that maybe they also might have the effect of creating a Stargate.
Well, I've heard that from many, many people, and, you know, in a certain sense, I'm open to the idea in that when you're dealing with the kind of physics that they're dealing with there, by the nature of the case, you are dealing with a hyperdimensional physics. In other words, I believe that they rationalized this device on the basis of scientific, and I should hasten to add, engineering papers that were published in Germany and in Europe between the wars, and each of these papers is a hyperdimensional mathematical treatise. So, in other words, they're dealing in mathematics of more than four spatial dimensions. So, yes, I do think that in that sense, yes, it's possible that this is a kind of a gate technology. But I want to caution everybody, because I get this all the time. Well, they ask me, could it have been dimensional portals for demons? Could it have been time machines of some sort, and so on and so forth? And usually people that ask these kinds of questions are not coming at it from the standpoint of the physics literature. The problem here is that in standard physics thinking, any sort of dimensional gateway like that falls subject to the limit of what's called the Schwarzschild limit, which is, to put it colloquially, a billion times tinier than tiny. In other words, very, very little could come through anything like that. But again, in the torsion model, that's very different. You're not subject to the same kind of constraints as standard physical theory is. So could it have been a gateway of some sort, a transducer of some sort? Well, absolutely. That's the whole point. You've got to be gating this energy from somewhere. And the whole idea of a dimensional gateway is kind of like a sluice gate in a dam. You know, you open the sluice gate and the water is going to flow downhill. So it's going to flow downhill from you know, 3+ n dimensions down into our three-dimensional reality.
Yeah, well, if we, I thought as strictly from a layman's point of view that I would ask the question, because obviously, you know, when you've been asked that question before, so I'm sure you understand that does come to mind.
Oh, sure,
but,
absolutely.
It does come to mind. One of the things that I also wanted to ask was that one of the German quantum mechanics professors that you mentioned had a theory of lattice work in dimensions, and I wanted to I'm not looking at the text right now, but that he had this lattice work theory of
yes, I think they're talking about Burkhard Heim.
All right, Burkhard Heim, and I wanted to be, you know, I was Burkhard Heim is fascinating. That's
oh, yes.
The
yes, he certainly was.
Yeah, and no arms, and lost his arms, and he was blind, and he was still, you know, it's almost like the Black Knight in Monty Python, you know, and he just,
yes.
You remember, he's down there on the ground saying, "That's all right, I'll bite you," and he still keeps going.
He was quite a man.
Yeah, and he had this theory that is kind of an advancement from Kozarev, would you say, or parallels? Or
well, I think to a certain extent that Heim and Kozarev were working independently, but came to very, very similar conclusions. Although Heim, from the literature I've been able to examine, Heim worked out his theory in much, much greater detail, and with much more formal explicitness, than did Kozarev. But in point of fact, they came to very, very similar conclusions that. Number one, if mankind is to have any genuine presence in space, it cannot be based on rockets. It's got to have a completely different paradigm of physics. It's got to have therewith a completely different paradigm of technology in order to have any really, truly lasting, permanent presence in deep space. And, of course, Heim was absolutely correct. And in fact, that was the motivation for him to develop his theory at the beginning. Now, in Heim's thinking, you're quite correct. He is dealing with a kind of a lattice work to the structure of space-time. And incidentally, I talk about a similar theory that was developed by a Ukrainian physicist by the name of Dr. Volodymyr Krasnoholovits in Kiev, that used to be very highly placed within the old Soviet defense ministry and doing theoretical research for them. And he's developed a very similar lattice work theory based on a kind of higher dimensional mathematics called topology, which, you know, is my favorite form of mathematics. I talk a lot about topology a lot in The Philosopher's Stone and Grid of the Gods, and I mentioned this theory in Giza, Death, Star, Destroyed.
You wanted to wrap this up in an hour here, so we've got about 5 minutes left, and this is your 5 minutes to talk about what you got coming up and what you'd like us to look out for in your website and what have you, so go ahead.
Well, I do have a book that is in press right now with my co-author, Dr. Scott DeHart, called Transhumanism, and the subtitle of that is A Grimoire of Alchemical Altars and Agendas for the Transformation of Man. That should be out by Farrell House later this year. He and I just published an e-book and a Lulu print-on-demand book called Yahweh, the Two-Faced God, and the subtitle to that is Theology, Terrorism, and Topology, which sounds like
Boy, that's
which sounds
good.
Like
oh,
a
that, that ought to be something. Yeah.
Oh, it is. The book has already had a lot of comments. Let me tell you. But we do talk about this ancient metaphor, this topological alchemical metaphor that we find in ancient texts quite a bit in that book, and contrast it to the so-called revealed monotheisms and what they're up to and how they've kind of used that metaphor as a tool of social engineering. But that book has just come out. I'm working right now on a second e-book with him, and also on my own book, which will be a sequel to my book Babylon's Banksters, which I'm hoping that Farrell House will do. I haven't talked to them directly about that. So I've got lots of projects in the pipe.
Yeah, you sure do. And what now? Tell us about your website.
My website is www.GizaDeathStar. That's GizaDeathStar.com. That's all one word. It's all lowercase. I do have a web store there that people can see all my books and buy my books right off the website. There's a members area on the website for subscribers that has interviews and special white papers just for the members. And I do a weekly blog, or a daily blog there, I should say, on that website.
You know, we can Google, if we Google Joseph P. Farrell, we'll get it all, I hope.
Yeah, you can Google me, or, you know,
yeah.
If you want to find out what I've written, you can go to Amazon. I have an author's page there on Amazon.
Good, great. This is terrific. Dr. Farrell, I want to thank you very, very much for being with us, and I know you got a cold, and you were you did. So I was going to say, take my kitchen alchemy remedy and see if it works for you.
All right.
But anyway, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I appreciate it.
I cannot recommend your Philosopher's Stone highly enough.
This is one.
Anyone at all interested in alchemy has got to have this book.
Well, thanks.
So thanks so much, and hopefully we'll see you again. And
all right.
Okay. Now next week we are going to go appropriate. Well, I don't know whether we can compare Philip K. Dick and Joseph P. Farrell, and they're two kind of differently, but we're gonna deal next week with the esoteric and somewhat hermetic writings of Philip K. Dick. We'll be dealing with his novel Valis, and his exegesis, which has just come out, which is 1,000 pages of crawling through Philip K. Dick's Dick's head, which I'm sure that everybody would be interested in, if you can put up with all of that. So next week, Philip K. Dick, and we'll see you then. And thanks again to Joseph P. Farrell for a wonderful, wonderful evening. And
thank you.
That's it for tonight, folks. And we'll see you next week. Have good magic.
Bye bye.